Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Australian Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Justin, your host for this episode. And today I'm joined by Patrick, the Chief Bitcoin Officer of Perth Heat. And Perth Heat is a baseball team, arguably the best goddamn baseball team as a part of the Australian Baseball League. They both accept Bitcoin payments for things like their merchandise and their ticket sales, and they also operate on a Bitcoin standard. How's it going, Patrick?
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
No worries at all. So what I'm trying to use this this platform for initially is to give people a bit of a chance to talk about their Bitcoin journey, as well as, you know, Bitcoin businesses that have integrated Bitcoin to some degree, to talk a bit about that process as well, pros and cons and how, you know, we went about it. And so there's not always a best way to do this, but sometimes chronologically and going from like personal journey to the business side of things kind of makes the most sense, as long as that seems appropriate to you too. Could we maybe just jump into it a bit in terms of, you know, how did you come across Bitcoin? How did you, you know, start getting interested in this space? Because obviously you've sort of made it a big part of your life. So yeah, if we could start with that, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. So I probably have a very stereotypical story as to how I was first touched or reached out to by Bitcoin, which is just in your general articles and knowledge before. Basically, everything prior to 2016 was just something through the legacy media, sort of feeding out what Bitcoin is and completely ignoring it and not really paying too much attention to it, just with other things happening. Then 2016 was really the year where I decided to start dabbling just in the technology side of things and in the idea that sounded like it was good, but really my understanding even then was quite limited just through lack of time and energy being able to devote to the space, and also thinking in my head, well, it's the energy spent devoting to the space is not well spent, you know, which is obviously now looking back a huge, probably the biggest mistake of my life. If you can, you know, if you can quantify those things, that's probably the dumbest decision I've ever made was at that time. But these things happen and you can either accept it and move forward and get in when you can, or you don't. And those things haunt you, a la Peter Schiff. But
exactly.
So, yeah. So the scenario was really 2016 and then just gradually learning more and more about it. And it just slowly but surely takes over your mind. But you have to remember that at that time, there wasn't near the education, there wasn't near the resources. So you weren't on your own. Obviously, there was lots of ways to communicate, but you had to do significantly more work to get past the level of, you know, the barrier to entry can sometimes be quite technical, especially early on. It can be quite technical, but there have been more and more people that have made it more approachable. And I don't have a scientific, you know, I don't have a computer science background. I don't have an economics background. This stuff is just learned along the way. And from that 2016 onwards, you know, slowly but surely started to make it more and more in my life. But I was really waiting for opportunities out there. I was always interested in investing and the derivatives market and things like that. But it really wasn't until, you know, probably 2019 that it really clicked and started to realize, well, we just need, basically, I was waiting for a huge test and to really sink my life's work into it or my life's energy, where I could point to be the most effective. And when 2020 hit and it reacted the way that it did, and we saw basically that it didn't capitulate into nothingness and eventually bounced back stronger and quicker, I think that was really the sign that, okay, this is, you know, it's at a level now where it's going to be really, really difficult to ignore any further for people even outside of my sphere, which is generally, you know, investment and sort of dorky stuff to begin with. Now it's going to be at the point where eventually it will get to a point where you just can't ignore it, and the general public will have to come across and see it because of the strength in the network. So,
it sounds like it's that very familiar trajectory of got into it maybe as a bit of an investment, or saw it perhaps as an investment vehicle, and that got you interested. But as you researched more, had it sort of touched you variously in different ways throughout those couple of years, all of a sudden it, you know, you really hit your stride. You see what it could possibly be. And I've got a very similar story, probably started about a year after you. I heard about it in 2015, didn't do anything about it. It was only until 2017 that I thought, oh, look, this thing keeps going up. I'll buy a little bit of it. And then over the next couple of years, just researching, trading, shitcoining, a bit of other things. And then around 2019, I realized I understand what this is now. And 2020, you're right, it really crystallized. And since then, it's been, you know, full steam ahead. I'm curious, did you, like, something that I experienced, and I'm noticing this theme with a lot of other Bitcoiners, is that there was a sense that something was broken before finding Bitcoin. but not really being able to put your finger on what was broken. And that might be like personally in your life, or it might be more sort of like broadly speaking, like, you know, there's something wrong with the world. Like, is it politics? Is it specific politicians or political parties? Is it corruption? Is it, you know, war? Like, there's all these things. And sure, you could say some of those things, arguably, there's some bad parts and good parts to it. But yeah, did you have that sense that like something's not quite right here? I don't know what I'm meant to do about it or what it is to fix it. And then Bitcoin presents itself more and more and more. And then suddenly, I get it now. I understand what's the root cause of all this. Like, does that resonate?
Absolutely. And I think it boils down to, because I've often thought about that very thing, the experience, the emotions that you are feeling, or the misguided nature that you are feeling in your mind when you think about things at a certain stage before you understand Bitcoin. And I guess I understand Bitcoin because of the show that we're on right now. But really, it came back to understanding money for me. Mm. That is what I realized, that I had no idea what money was before Bitcoin. So Bitcoin was the way that I realized what money was. And that was the thing that I had no idea before. And that was always back in the back of my mind. I didn't know how it worked. I just used it. It's like often when I'm having orange pill conversations with individuals or corporations or whoever it is nowadays, I will say it's like a, you know, it's like getting a tool, but not getting an instruction manual. So you just have to figure out how to use this tool, and you're going to use it incorrectly probably your entire life, unless someone who comes along goes, actually, you know, you hit the nail with the hammer. You don't, try and dig a hole with it, you know, where you could spend your whole life going, oh, I don't have an instruction manual. I'm just going to do this. And it's never taught because no one else understands it, right? That's the scary part. Mm. Like, one of the scariest parts about Bitcoin is you realize why no one knows what money is because, well, why you don't know what money is because nobody knows what money is. So they can't teach what they don't know. Yeah. So this huge gaping hole all of a sudden is realized. And that's why you often get this, you know, Michael Saylor often talks about the moment that he got it, he had a hard time sleeping, knowing that someone else was going to think about it and someone else was going to get it too, because it is this realization.
Yeah.
You're talking about an individual who has amassed billions of dollars worth of energy in the fiat world, wasn't able to put his finger on it immediately. So it's not like it's not a public shame to say you don't understand it. It's a completely foreign concept, and you shouldn't understand it to a certain extent, right? You'd be very lucky if you just came out of the womb and, you know, you understood what Bitcoin is. It's just not the way that it operates in the world that we are in today. So I think that was the really big aha moment. Was not only did I not understand Bitcoin, which is huge when you're just starting out trying to understand Bitcoin, but I really couldn't understand Bitcoin until I understood what money was. And that was really the big breakthrough.
Definitely. And I, you know, there's almost no point trying to figure out why we weren't educated about money and why we still really aren't educated about money. I think partly is because no one can explain it very well without showing that there's many, many logical inconsistencies baked into the very premise of it, which then becomes a very difficult topic to educate someone on because there's too many questions, there's not enough answers. You know, whether that's part of the reason or whether it's, you know, because I know some people will say, oh, look, it's by design. You know, no one wants you to know about money. That way this can keep going on forever and ever. And regardless of that, like I've noticed in psychology, especially, and even just sort of in our culture, we have this belief around money where it shouldn't be that important. Like money doesn't buy happiness. People who are, you know, fixated on money are greedy. There's even a lot of research to say like, oh, look, populations without that much wealth, they're relatively satisfied and happy compared to other populations with a lot of wealth. And there's lots of ways to actually criticize that research and say, well, that's not quite right. But I guess the point here is that we've been almost indoctrinated over the course of time, whether by design or whether by just, you know, incentives, and becomes a bit of a runaway train. But we've been incentivized to not pay attention to money, to say life is about other things. And certainly life is about other things. But when the core basis of life is like our energy, our time, and money is a representation of that, or at least it's meant to be a representation of that. I don't think the currency that we have, fiat currencies, are really money. It really opens your eyes, doesn't it? And I think Michael Saylor talks about this so well. Nick Szabo, you know, talking about the history of money. And of course, Saifedean, the Bitcoin standard, the history of gold, which is essentially probably the best money we've had prior to Bitcoin. It's really eye-opening. And what you mentioned, that quote from Michael Saylor of like having sleepless nights once he realized it, because he realized other people will start understanding this too. Yeah, I get that. It resonates with me completely. And it's nice that more people, seems like a one-way street, are like opening their eyes to it a bit more. And it's easier to talk about this stuff now too, because no longer when I say something like I talk about Bitcoin for my job, people are like, oh, scam coin, what's that doing now? It's like people actually go like, oh, Bitcoin, okay, is it? Yeah, so what's about that? I've heard about the energy thing. And all of a sudden it's like, wow, great, we've actually got an inroad here to talk about this in an intelligent manner where they're starting to understand. And they're starting to see the problem too, which is that the current, in quotations, money is failing them. And it has been failing them for a long time. It's just now the cracks are becoming, you know, much more apparent.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right in the sense that people are, at least what I have experienced since the announcement, especially, the Perth Heat has opened the door to normal legacy media operations and even normies like pre-coiners to the idea that this isn't the general feeling that Bitcoin itself, cryptocurrency, by the definition that others bring to it, is somehow scammy. That seems to be completely gone. Out of all of the interactions that I have had, we have never once been met with, well, this is obviously a scam. You guys are doing some sort of scam or involved in some, and that was simply not the case 2 or 3 years ago. You know, like so much of the narratives has shifted because of the education, because of the infrastructure, because of the price, essentially, and the thing not dying. Right? Like the number one skill of just not going away and continuing to be there, that really has shifted the narrative. So it's becoming significantly easier to have those initial orange pill sessions if you can at least start from a foundation of, well, there might be something to this, rather than it's completely negative right from the start.
That's right. I think Bitcoin survivability, it's becomes its inevitability to some degree. The longer it hangs around for, the longer it is recognizable, even if price fluctuates, even if there's FUD that comes and cycles again years to come. It just becomes more of something that people expect to see. It becomes familiar, and usually familiarity is what makes things feel less risky. It's not always the case, but that's the way our mind works. Once we're familiar with something, we're more likely to go towards it and spend time with it.
Absolutely.
Over your personal journey, was there any books, anything that you've read that's been, oh, like, I'm sure you've read many things, don't get me wrong, but anything that was particularly salient that stands out when someone says, oh, look, I'm really getting into this, what should I read? You know, give me something that's going to let me really sink my teeth into this topic, apart from just a conversation. Like, is there something that you tend to either recommend to people, or at least you have in the back of your mind as almost like a, you know, the sort of the concepts, the examples, to then, you know, distill that to people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is now, it wasn't the initial job description, but this is basically what I do now, is try and understand what the most efficient path from zero allocation to maximum allocation is in a journey for someone being welcomed into the Bitcoin community, like just understanding what the quickest ways to do that. And personally, I have built up over the years, just built up the first 100 hours in Bitcoin, right? You end up talking to so many people. At least if you're someone like myself, if I don't actively go out and try and orange pill people, you know, it's just not my personality. But I am more than happy to have a conversation with people if they show interest. And like we were talking about before, that interest, the number of people showing interest has started to rise as price has risen and as infrastructure has been built up. So there's certainly more of that. So I have a little PDF that you know, I'm happy to share. My first 100 hours in Bitcoin, these are the best steps. These are the people to go to. These are the people to listen to. And this is what I think. This is not the way that I did it, but this is certainly now the most, it's not basic. It's the most thorough understanding of every single level along the way that you need to understand. Because I think, I'll harp on this all day in every conversation that I get into. And actually, there's a fun story I might tell after this about, we had a meeting yesterday where this exact thing happened, where I am a huge proponent of the idea that you can't understand Bitcoin and the impact it is going to have if you don't understand money. So the money conversation takes about 30 minutes, right? If you don't do that, those necessary steps to understand what money is and what it represents and that it's a tool and all of these things, you just can't quite grasp Bitcoin. And it's hard because for those first 30 minutes, you're not really getting anywhere in the Bitcoin world, and people can lose interest or they can be completely overwhelmed. But I say do the hard work upfront, if you're willing to understand that. And it's also one of those moments where you immediately have a win. You have a quick, easy win, because as soon as people understand what money is, they realized what they have thought that money was, or the fact that they have ignored it their entire life, creates a gross disadvantage to them operating in the real world and providing any value. So as soon as they get that quick win, well, then they say, okay, well, if you showed me that, what else can you show me?
Yeah,
it's like building that trust and that connection. But you know, it's very hard to do over Christmas dinner, or, you know, I just don't even bother in those situations anymore. It's just like, well, you know, if you really are interested, I'm happy to send you this stuff. If you read that stuff, or if you listen to the podcast, or you watch the videos and you have any questions, let me know. But on a personal level nowadays, it's really, you've got to be quite enthusiastic to get the full orange pill treatment.
I think we all fell into that trap. I mean, I know I certainly did. For the first year or two after really realizing Bitcoin is a thing, like I talked about cryptocurrency a lot when I got into that too, but once I realized Bitcoin was the thing, I went like 10 times harder. However, I think that would have either put a lot of people off, made them resistant, and led to not a lot of very fruitful conversations or enjoyable conversations for both of us, because it'd be frustrating for me as well. We're like, why aren't people interested in this? This is like the most important thing happening in the world and probably will be for the next few hundred or thousand years. And no one's really keen to know about this sort of stuff. And you get to a certain point where I think you build your confidence in it and you understand it well enough. And then you also realize that the best orange pill is when someone comes to you and starts asking about it, or they have a problem which you can then present it in a way that is they're primed for. That PDF that you mentioned, have you made that available publicly somewhere, or would you be willing to, you know, perhaps after this podcast for me to like link it up or something like that, or even maybe the
I mean, I can share it with you. You could do with it as you please. It's all in the public knowledge stuff. So yeah, it's more like the delineation of this is where I would start.
Yeah, I have a document that I've just been adding things to as I go, although I've probably after the first like 15 or 20 links, I stopped really organizing it too much and putting in little cliff notes for myself about what it all was. So now when I look at that and someone says, you know, give me something to read to start with, I kind of feel a bit overwhelmed, where I'm like, all of this is great, but it's, you know, the level of assumed knowledge is far too great. And so often I end up sending something like The Bullish Case for Bitcoin by Vijay Buryapati, because it's just such a great place to start. But yeah, I'll grab that from you a little bit later, perhaps, and put it up, because I'm sure other people are building their orange pill guide as well. And, you know, always good to have it there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like you said, one of the most important things that people often forget as they get into the space and they get more knowledgeable, and that knowledge reinforces conviction, and the conviction reinforces investment, and the investment continues to rise. And you know, you think during the bull market period, you think you're the smartest person to ever walk the earth and that you have all of this knowledge. What's really easy to do is to forget forget how it felt when you didn't know, and to forget how hard it was to accumulate the information necessary to have the conviction, because it's such an easy step to skip over. You know, that's why I've done a number of things across my Bitcoin journey, just even outside of Bitcoin. This is just a pattern that I have noticed and just started to keep track all along the way, much like you said about keeping that list. But I need my own proof of work of this is what led to this realization, and this is what led to this realization. And then that stack starts to grow, and you can look back and say, okay, you know, maybe I'm not an idiot. Because that is, once you understand Bitcoin, or at least when you think you understand what Bitcoin is and the potential that it has to increase efficiency throughout the world to such an extent that we've never seen before, and access energy that we've never had access to before, and just how powerful that is going to be. Number one, you know, in your own head, you sound crazy. You know, there's a point where you have to convince yourself that you're not crazy. And I'm still doing that, right? Every day, I want to be able to argue the flip side of Bitcoin arguments better than I can argue the Bitcoin side of things. Like, I need to know, because I have a ton of incentive to be the first one to know if something is wrong with Bitcoin.
Yeah.
If I have made if I have miscalculated or misjudged the network or the participants or the incentives or money itself, you won't find anybody more motivated than me to gather that information as quick as possible. So I think that's, you know, it's just something to keep in the back of your mind if you're brand new, or even if you're getting a little bit of knowledge yourself and you're starting to orange peel. Just remember how overwhelming it is at the beginning, and how, like you say, it's about identifying little tiny wins that you can give someone, and really reading the audience and the room and saying, you know, Bitcoin is, you often see that description of it, like the blindfolded scientist feeling an elephant, right? And they all feel the different parts, and they're like, no, it's a hose, or it's a white water, or if it's a pillar.
Yeah.
Like, it's all of those things. It's just about understanding. You have to have such a level of comfort in understanding technical knowledge and economic knowledge that you can be adaptable to any conversation and try and find those little wins. And the more that you do it, the more you get comfortable with it, and the more you start to convince yourself, okay, you know, I am actually, well, maybe I'm still crazy, but at least I know something about this, you know.
Yeah. This makes sense. So true. You need to be, what's the term? It's like a polymath. So you need to understand philosophy. You need to understand psychology. You need to understand economics. You need to understand a bit about the financial system. You need to, of course, understand history. You need to understand a little bit of things like computer science and cryptography. Because I think understanding the technicals of Bitcoin really, it builds that confidence that this isn't something that can just be hacked or just be replaced by something else. And actually, it's quite elegant in its design and engineering. And it's been designed actually really over more like 50 years than just like came out of nowhere. Sure, there's some innovations in there, but it's technology that's been built up for quite a while. And something that you touched on there is, I think, really salient. And it's that Bitcoiners, and like especially yourself and myself, are very adversarial thinkers or cynics. I mean, I know I would have called myself a cynic before this, where every time that something is presented to me, I'm starting to try to pick it apart and say, well, how does this break or how does this not work? And if it doesn't, then I feel very motivated and I want to learn more. But it doesn't stop me saying, how does this break? How does this fall apart? I'm still picking. I'm still looking for those little flaws. And firstly, that helps to settle my own mind and be very comfortable and confident going forward, but also to have those conversations, of course. And I think that that adversarial mindset, that cynicism, Bitcoiners have a lot of that, which is why Bitcoin leads to so many other tangents related to like health and food and kind of get into all that maybe a bit later. But like there's a lot of tangents that lead from Bitcoin, don't they, that aren't even specifically or seemingly related to Bitcoin. And it's because we have that cynical mindset. We want information. And then when we find information that is completely incongruous with the reality that's presented to us, we're willing to say, well, let's reconceptualize reality. Let's just not get rid of this information and say, well, I'll just keep eating up the reality that I'm fed. You know, we're willing to sort of bend the perception to fit what the evidence is. And I think that's probably inherent in open networks to a certain degree, because everything's laid out there for everyone to see, rather than a centralized closed source network where no one really gets to be too adversarial. At least you don't get to leverage or crowdsource the entire world to look at it in an adversarial light. And then all of a sudden things come to the surface that are very, very useful to know. And I think Bitcoin has that, which is beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Bitcoiners in general, at least, you know, I can speak for myself in the way that I approach Bitcoin. Still to this day, when I'm trying to understand a certain concept or I'm trying to see which side of the debate, if you come in late to a technology issue or an economic policy issue, like if you come in late and there are two sides already established, the way that I approach it is that I know for a fact that I have been bamboozled before. My mind is fallible enough to be fooled before by shiny objects or you know, words that I can't understand. So be open to the idea that I am going to be wrong. So I would rather find out by doing the research and actually figuring, okay, I know that I'm prone to being wrong. So what are the steps that would cause me to disprove that I am wrong? You know, instead of proving that I am right, I want to know all of the other side of things so that I can objectively say, oh, okay, well, this just happens to be the case. And now I need to change. I need to be adaptable. I think Bitcoiners know, especially like even if you are a hardcore Bitcoiner, like you're a Bitcoin maxi and you have been since 2015, just the number of things that you have had to adapt to in infrastructure, in network, in interacting with Bitcoin, it's constant and it's only getting quicker and it's only going to get quicker. So if you don't have adaptable, if you're, one of your skills is not being adaptable, it's going to be hard to make it just as a Bitcoin pleb, because these things are moving so quickly and it's overtaking the legacy system so quickly that people are going to be looking for answers. And just being involved with a network on a pleb level, you're going to come across situations where you're going to have to explain things, or you're going to even have to figure things out for yourself on, you know, do I want to keep my coins on custodian A or B or hold them myself? Or what are the pros? What are the cons? Like there is no rest in the Bitcoin world for Bitcoin plebs.
And it's a superpower they have as well, to be able to be wrong or to be able to say, I don't know. Because I think that really helps, because we all have biases. You know, we have these heuristics that our brain is constantly running to try to make our whole decision-making process a bit easier and to sort of like get rid of the extraneous stuff. But unfortunately, some of that stuff it gets rid of is actually very valid information that we need to be aware of. And we never get rid of our biases or those heuristics. But if we know they exist, we can actually say, kind of like what you just said, I know I've been wrong before. So let me look at this and let me look at it again. And then let me see if I can pick holes in what I'm looking at to really understand this. And now let me explain it to someone else and let's hear their criticisms. And rather than get frustrated by the criticisms, take that on board and try to integrate that and continue going. Like it takes a lot of leaving ego at the door, I guess, to say, you know, I don't know everything, but I know enough about this and I'm really curious to know more. And hey, let's try to explore this together. Like I think Bitcoiners are willing to do that. Whereas unfortunately, and I know this from my past in psychology, not many people are willing to do that. Most people believe the way they see it is the way it is. And of course, if they're presented with something different, it's frustrating. They get their back against the wall and they get defensive rather than saying, oh, it's actually totally fine to be wrong. That's just a thought that I had. And I was thinking maybe not the quite right thing, you know, based on that that evidence. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense, I think, that we've got this this openness.
That's it. Yeah. And you mentioned leaving ego at the door. I always think back to as soon as you can admit to yourself that you're going to be wrong, or you're going to misread a statement or misjudge a situation and be wrong. As soon as you have that splinter in your mind, that could be a possibility, you have to account for that. And I always think back to Michael Saylor, you know, talking about how you could have been the person that said fire was not possible. Anybody that tries to get fire is an idiot. It's never going to work. You're never going to be able to control the thing. You're never going to be able to start the thing yourself. But as soon as you came across someone that had done that, it is in your, that it has controlled fire and said, would you like some? The answer is yes. The answer is always yes. When someone has done the work, instead of saying, well, no, I thought it was wrong, so this can't be right, so I need to reformulate my model to make sure this, this is an anomaly and this can't go on forever, the easiest thing to do, and the thing that you are incentivized to do if you understand what money is, and that you understand that all human action is a game of lowering entropy in the world around you to create access to as many energy reserves as you possibly can. That is the whole goal of everything that you are doing, that we are doing right now. It's accumulation of energy reserves and having access to those when you need them. Well, then when you come across the guy with fire, you say, okay, yeah, this makes sense for me. Like, I don't need to be the one that discovered fire. You already did the hard work. Let me reap the benefits.
And it's a communal thing, because, you know, an open network like that means that you don't become unuseful or you know, without utility because someone else discovered it before you, because you can build on that. I mean, fire is that 0 to 1. But nowadays we have so many things that most people wouldn't even link back to the discovery of something like fire. But it is. And it's because we've just extrapolated so far beyond that. I think being able to embrace things rather than have, what have we coined it? Bitcoin derangement syndrome, where someone says, no, yeah, this is an anomaly. This goes against my life's work, or this goes against something that I said last week. So I couldn't possibly ever adopt it or give it any kind of credibility. So I'm just going to fight it. I'm going to fight it. Even in the face of all overwhelming evidence, I'll keep fighting it. We see a lot of people like that. And, you know, I think some of them will, maybe in the fullness of time, like Peter Schiff, join the Bitcoin side. I feel like that's like some weird sort of redemption arc in the making, especially with his son. But I guess we'll have to wait and see. But yeah, I think there are a lot of people that will be eating some, what's the term, like humble pie later down the track, as it just, like, you need a thesis. You need a point where you say, okay, I was wrong. Like, if I'm correct, these are the criteria, yes, you know, which I would expect to see. And if I'm wrong, these are the criteria which should fail, or perhaps the criteria on the good side, which will start to be accomplished. But you need to have that. I think some people settle in their position to say Bitcoin's not a thing, and they don't have that criteria on the flip side. So they're not looking for those, you know, milestones to be met.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you have to identify what their downside incentive is to continue to hold on to a thought that they know is not correct. Like, some people have enough incentive to hold on to that thought forever. You know, some people do have those incentives. So it's not going to be for everybody. But I think, you know, the classic saying of you get the price, you get Bitcoin at the price you deserve, is very true.
It's a good way to capture it, for sure.
Yeah.
So your journey with Perth Heat, like, when did you join Perth Heat?
At the beginning of 2020, officially, to come on board and sort of see the transition over.
Gotcha. And is your link in with Perth Heat with Steve, the CEO? Is that primarily
He was the original individual that I orange-pilled. And I've told this story on a number of different podcasts, but I'm happy to share it here again.
Just please.
The idea of, you know, my goal was never to set out going, okay, well, I can orange-pill a whole organization if I get to one individual. It just happened through the conversations, like we said, of slowly but surely finding solutions for people that you care about, and sharing that information in a way that is open and makes it accessible and doesn't make somebody feel like an idiot. Once you do that, Steve was, to his credit, very open-minded to the idea that this could have solutions immediately and could recognize the impact of first mover advantage, which is something I harped on at the time, because if, you know, this is the 0 to 1 of absolute scarcity, means that if you can recognize this information before other people, before other entities, doesn't have to be people, you are going to receive outsized proportions of beneficial return. It's mind-boggling that people don't understand that fact. But as soon as you see it, it's very hard not to see. So to Steve's credit, he understood that this was something that he couldn't sleep on, right? He had to act, much like Saylor had to act. And once you, again, back to the energy thing, once you understand what we are trying to do as human beings, and you understand that this is an energy reserve accumulation game, how can we, how can he, I should say, as the CEO of the Perth Heat, how can he transform as many energy components into usable energy for himself and for the team, which he looks after, and for the organization that he looks after. This is the path forward. The easiest thing, or the best thing, the best use of his time, like the best use of our time right now, having this conversation, is to go on a Bitcoin standard and show the world that it can be done, and adopt Bitcoin on the balance sheet for the treasury side of things, start taking Bitcoin for merchandise, all the things you mentioned at the top of the show. He quickly realized that this was an organization is simply a collection, a collective of individuals who are pointing at the same goal. And that goal is unlocking energy reserves. It just so happens to be in sports that we're doing it. And we are so far away from people understanding what money is that people don't understand why sports exist, right? They can't, no one can verbalize why sports exist, or why they should exist, or the good that they, or the value that they provide, or the utility that they provide. That's how far away we've gotten from things. Nobody has any idea. And when we say Bitcoin fixes sports, Bitcoin does fix sports. But before we fix sports with Bitcoin, we have to lay the foundation of Bitcoin in the world. And that's what we realized along the way is this is all about, you cannot, in a war, you cannot just be a carpenter, or you cannot be a blacksmith, right? In a war, you have to be a soldier first. And you have to go out there, and we are in a war with the legacy system. We are in a marketing war that they have been winning. And you know, to its credit, Bitcoin for the last 12 years has been in a position where it's been really hard to be on the offensive, because the smart, intelligent people are having to build the network up. They're having to do all of the work behind the scenes. The last thing that they are worried about is the marketing. Again, there's no central institution here that can say, well, this is actually pretty good if we did some sort of marketing campaign for Bitcoin. There's none of that. So as the network has matured, as Bitcoin has matured and more infrastructure has been built up around it, now we can start to have the division of labor and the specialties. And that, we think, is the value add of Perfeet outside of baseball, outside of being on a Bitcoin standard. We can now be a mouthpiece for the positive aspects of Bitcoin, and we can go on the offensive. So the default should be all of these things, like we mentioned earlier, about having the conversations with legacy media and how the negative first impressions are slowly getting knocked back, right? Well, our goal is to just make, instead of just being neutral, our goal is to have them be positive, on the front foot positive, the very first time they hear about it. They should hear solutions before they hear problems. And that really is the hole that we have identified, which simply isn't, not because people weren't interested in it, but people were more useful doing other things with Bitcoin than this. And now it's at a point where, okay, well, now a corporation can do this. This can be our main goal. Is to do this, because we know that if we want to be the best possible baseball team that we can be and be as efficient as at transforming energy as we possibly can at baseball, we can't do it from a soft foundation. We need to be building on a foundation of granite, and that is Bitcoin. And as soon as Bitcoin is the default, well, then we'll be that much more efficient doing baseball. But until that point, we really now have two jobs, which is education and baseball.
That makes a lot of sense. And I like that metaphor of building on a solid foundation rather than something like sand, which becomes very precarious. You need to have at its core first principles, something that you know is incorruptible, you know, permissionless, censorship resistant, all the adjectives that we know about Bitcoin. There's a little tangent there that you mentioned that I wouldn't mind going down briefly, because I know this is something that comes up in like Bitcoin space. So you said we've gotten to such a point, you know, in reality where people have lost sight of the benefits, the utility of things like sports. Do you have a way of summing that up? Like if someone said to you, like, what's the point of sport? What's the point of playing baseball? Or what's the point of going and seeing a baseball game? Like, what would you tell someone like that to kind of get them to see that perspective of like, this has a societal positive influence, or an individual positive influence? What would you tell a person like that?
Yeah, easy. Again, based on how much time I had with that person.
Yeah,
first,
true. Yeah,
first fair thing enough. I'd go to is, okay, if you want to understand, well, I would ask them what they thought it was, first of all, and they would probably say entertainment or, you know, you can build a community with people that come together and see sports live in a real game. You can be part of something bigger. All of those things are good. Now, what is the end goal of all of those things, though? What's the end goal of entertainment? Why is entertainment good? What's the end goal of community? Why is building a community good? Okay, well, we have to go back to the whole purpose of life, lowering entropy in the world around you, which is basically taking energy that is in an unusable form and turn it into a usable form that you can have access to anytime you want. Okay, so that is the goal of human action. Now let's take that and apply it to sport. How are sports going to transform more energy than if they didn't exist, right? How is the community going to get access to more energy reserves if sports exist versus if they didn't exist? And this one has been corrupted because you see advertisements, you see the showboat attitude of athletes, and it's very hard. It gets muddled what the purpose is. And the easy answer is that if you can understand that all we're trying to do is transform energy from an inaccessible state to an accessible one, sports act as a mirror or an example for low time preference behavior. They always have. That's why people look up to athletes. That's why people look up to sports. Because in a condensed 3-hour Sunday afternoon, you can see what hard work, determination, practice, overcoming resilience, teamwork, cooperation, you can see all of those things come together and you can lead by example from the front. And those things are hard to practice. They're hard to lay out and show individuals. And that is the utility, is people seeing that and becoming inspired to do that exact same thing. Because if you inspire those individuals to partake in those activities, show them what is possible. If you work hard and you practice and you don't give up and you get knocked down and you get back up, what happens? You win. And if you win in the game of baseball, okay, that's great. You get a little championship trophy. If you show people that those are the characteristics that you need to win, and people take that out into the community and they put that into their own lives, more energy is transformed, right? Those people do better than those that don't. And you know that you want to be surrounded by individuals who are at their personal energy transformation peak. We want those individuals out there because through cooperation, through exchange, that makes everyone else's lives better. So we need those examples. And it's in a little 3-hour snippet, right? It doesn't take you 7 years to see the progress of all of these things come to play. You see it each and every afternoon across the world. And that is why people look up to sports. That is why brands associate with sports, because they want to steal those things and say, hey, I don't know, Deutsche Bank that sponsors some soccer team, we also like hard work and determination, right? It's through association. They're trying to capture that. So the essence of sports is setting an example to show you what low time preference behavior looks like, and then using that as a mirror that you can go out and operate whatever your normal task is, however you transform energy in your life. Using that as a base to launch and go, okay, these are some of the principles that I can follow to be as effective as I can be at transforming energy.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think coming back to first principles is a really beautiful way to view the world and then to extrapolate things out to see whether it's going to be positive just at that base level. And I think the way that you've explained that, you know, sports being one of the best examples and most accessible example of low time preference behavior, and also at its root, just being a way to convert inaccessible energy to accessible energy, which is what we're all trying to do. That is the game of life and the entire society. Yeah, I think that's a great way of looking at it. And in psychology, we're constantly looking for things like upwards and downward cycles or spirals, because it's never just one thing. It's never like, sometimes we talk about the straw that breaks the camel's back. You know, it's a nice saying, but it's usually cumulative over time and compounding. So like the Pareto principle, compounding interest, it goes both ways, really. And so you're right, you know, that community participation, the changing that can do to our thinking and motivation, the putting in, you know, physical time and energy and effort, following that up with like things like good nutrition, you know, all this stuff actually leads to great physical health, great mental health, and then a great community health. And all of a sudden that starts to be contagious to even people that just watch that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's not a surprise that people look up to athletes for all of those things that you just mentioned. And that is also something that we are well aware of. Once you understand that and you know that, okay, well, now we can leverage that to our advantage to help in the education process. It's like we are in a very unique spot as a professional sports team to, you almost are Trojan horsing the education aspect of Bitcoin here. Because we control our broadcast, because we can control the team, the individuals that play for the team, the messages that are coming from the team, everyone comes to the heat through the 32 years of the organization, the proof of work we've done in the community. They already come with an open mind of, they know that we want to be the best baseball team that we can possibly be. So if we're doing this, there must be a reason behind it. And it's that opening. It's just that, again, that Trojan horse of, here's entertainment, here is sports, this is fun, watch it. You're going to get all those things we just talked about, naturally, even if you don't recognize you're getting those things. But we're also going to now show you how you can take more advantage of that, or how you can be more efficient in your own life. And that's really why the main thing, and we talked about this for the year leading up to what was going to happen, the main message that we wanted to get across was that this is a change from the top down. It's not from the bottom that this thing is starting to build. In the organization, the default is Bitcoin, right? If you want to do outside work, you can go the fiat world, right? People will have obligations in fiat. You'll have to do that work. But the default now is Bitcoin. And that will get people to ask why, ask questions that they have much greater incentive, because if they don't ask any questions, they're just stuck with Bitcoin. So now we're putting the onus on the individuals to say, hey, obviously we want to be the best team ever. We think that this is going to get us there. You are part of this organization. We think this is going to help you. This is the default. If you have any questions, we have the resources, but really now it's on you. But if you don't want to learn, and we will opt in for you. And now it's your job to go to the default where you're getting taken advantage of. And I think that really is the big shift in the story. And what people have responded to the most is that it doesn't take orange pilling 50 people all at the same time. It takes orange pilling one person that can say, okay, this is the default because it's going to make the organization better.
Mm. And a learning that I had in some dabbling that I've done in organizational psychology is that culture has to be top down. If there is a value that is disseminated even from the top down, but not lived, it normally isn't then basically communicated and acted upon by everyone, you know, on the lower levels. And sure, grassroots movements can certainly make that bubble to the top, but it takes much longer. It's much more of a fight, and it is much more divisive. Whereas you're right, when it's some person or a small group of people that is able to then filter down that information, that generally speaking in organizations is when culture becomes very prolific and accepted, because it's lived and it comes from, you know, the ultimate decision maker or makers. I feel like with athletes, they are probably more primed to understand Bitcoin than many others, maybe even people that work in things like the financial sector or economists that use like Keynesian monetarist theories. The reason being is that athletes have like a prime age to be able to compete and train, and they peak and then they start to come down from that peak. And I mean, I guess you could look at everything like this to a certain degree, but athletes have, you know, a very particular window that they need to, you know, make hay while the sun shines, as the saying goes. And so I'm curious, does that resonate with you? Like, of the people that you've talked to, have you noticed that maybe athletes are more primed to understand, you know, conservation of energy, like make the most usable energy that they can and be able to conserve that for the future, knowing that they're not always going to be able to do this same thing. Whereas someone who's working in a, you know, an office job could do that until quite literally the day that they retire or the day that they die. So it might feel less of an imperative to try to say, let's make the most of what we're doing now, you know, what we're, you know, sacrificing now. Do you feel like athletes are more primed for that? What do you think?
I would say that's a gross understatement. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, they're the easiest people because they understand low time preference, but also because there is an objective truth to, depending on what the sport is and how involved the athlete is in the sport, where they understand that if I don't do the work, then I don't get any better. And if I don't get any better, then all of the risk that I have taken up until now, all of the opportunity costs of investing practice and time and energy into this, I completely wasted it. I should have put that somewhere else to gain the resources that we talked about before. The transformation of the energy comes, and it comes in that last half of 1%, right? It's those individuals that recognize that at a certain level, you know, all of the people that play in the baseball league, they're fantastic baseball players, right? There's no doubt about it. So how do you get ahead? You have to do those little tiny things with a purpose, with the idea that I'm going to make an investment. It's such a risky business. You think about the time and energy that goes into being a professional athlete. You quickly realize, and you can quickly spot bullshit when it happens or when someone's telling you bullshit, because you know, I have to do the work to get better. I have to put in the hours of practice to get better. I have to study the film to get better. I have to eat better. If no one's going to eat for me, right? I have control over my body to do this eating. If I'm fat, it's because I ate. It's because I didn't do these things that were necessary to be successful. And you can instantly see it. There's no like, well, you know, I didn't eat very well and I didn't work out and I didn't practice. But we almost won. It's like, no, you didn't. You lost. You lost in a big way. And these are the exact reasons you lost for. So fix those. And that's why they're very prone to understanding that Bitcoin is, especially with the absolute scarcity side of things, it seems to be the easiest cohort of individuals to understand. Oh, I see it. I see it.
It's proof of work, really, isn't it? At the epitome. Like I played baseball when I was a kid, but I haven't for about 20 years. But Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu has been more so the thing in the recent years. And sometimes people will visit from other gyms, and the gym that I'm at is very, very strict on their rankings. There is no specific criteria. It's more so, you know, you go up a belt when the instructor thinks that you're ready to go up a belt. Whether that takes 6 months or 6 years, doesn't matter. But people would sometimes visit from other gyms, and they would be a belt or two level above you. And you would think, oh, shit, you know what? I want to roll with them. That's just going to going to ruin my day. You roll with them and you trash them and you just think, I don't know how they got that. That's not proof of work. And I think sports, especially sports that are, well, I think most sports are competitive. I can't really think of one that's an exception to that now that I've just mentioned that statement. But I think sports are one of the epitome of proof of work, where it almost doesn't matter, you know, what the status or what you say or what someone says about you. It's really what happens on the field or wherever it is that you, you know, you do your sport. And that makes the most sense that that would then convert to something like Bitcoin, which is really based around proof of work. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny that you mentioned Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I as well am a BJJ practitioner.
Nice.
And one of the things that you quickly realize from the outside is that there are not many BJJ gyms that have, or studios that have, a bad vibe, right? You know, everyone in there is nice as can be. And you have to say, okay, well, why is everyone so nice when they're inside the jiu-jitsu? It's because they know that they know exactly where they stand in the hierarchy of truth. If I get into a match with this person, I'm going to lose, right? And there's a winner and there's a loser. So I'm going to shake hands. I'm going to be nice. I'm going to smile. I'm going to be nice to the people above me because they're being nice to me. I'm going to be nice to the people below me because the people above me are being nice to me. Like, it's a very place where you cannot, there's no getting away from the truth that certain individuals can manhandle other people.
You know,
and that makes for a very, once the truth is out there and known by everyone, because you can't hide it. You cannot shield it in a cloud of, you know, word salad. It's like either this person can strangle you or they can't strangle you.
Yep.
So again, an idea that Bitcoin being an open source ledger where everyone can see all of the transactions and everyone is pointing a gun at everybody else and keeping everyone honest. As soon as the truth is out there, well, then it allows for this different type of relationship to form with everyone inside of the network.
Very true. That transparency, that openness is probably, again, one of Bitcoin's greatest strengths for that reason. I'm curious, going back a few steps, talking about like orange pilling Steve, was there something that you think he was primed for? Like, is it that he has this background in sports and in baseball, that he understands proof of work? So when you sort of put it in the right framework, he was able to just grasp it? Or has there been things, do you think, in his life or in his, you know, education, his understanding of the world, that's made him maybe more primed for Bitcoin than, say, someone else in another organization, this hypothetical organization, you know, where someone's trying to orange pill their manager or their CEO? Like, do you think Steve was like more primed for some reason, or was he just like coming in pretty cold and it just took time and took the right conversations?
No, I don't know if he has anything in his personal background that would make him prime. I mean, obviously the involvement in sports, he's been involved in sports his whole life. That does open up certain pathways to thinking, like we've been discussing.
True.
But really it comes from a place of wanting to know the answer because of intrigue, you know, seeing, just basically being enthusiastic, like you are about anything in life that you want to get good at or that you want to understand more. It comes from a genuine interest in, this is something that I don't understand, a curiosity to try and better yourself. And it doesn't even have to do with the idea, you know, like Steve's original interest was just in understanding the technology. It wasn't in, you know, I heard this thing can make me rich, or, you know, I want to make, you know, Silk Road payments or something like that. It was none of that. It was just a genuine interest in the technology and what he had heard. And then really, again, I'll tout this again. as soon as he was able to understand what money was, that's it. You have them sold on, well, now I understand what money is. And if it's technology and it's a tool and its main purpose is there to facilitate exchange, because exchange, somebody smart a long time ago figured out that if we cooperate, we can actually transform more energy than if we were on our own, right? If you understand that, okay, well, how do we make exchange more efficient? How do we make it more open? How do we encourage more of that? How can we have an economy that isn't limited by physical location? Well, these are all the things we can do now. And that is better than the legacy system. And if it's 0.001% better over time, that leads to astronomical efficiencies in energy. And more energy you have, the more energy you have access to, the better your life. And you can think about that as a single person. Like, if I have energy reserves for a certain amount of time, does that make me more effective? Yes. If it makes a single person more effective, it makes the whole world more effective. As soon as you realize that, you say, okay, what's a game now? How do I unlock as much energy as I can? How do I store it? What's the best way to store it? How do I store it in other people? And then as soon as he was able to grasp what is happening at the transactional level, when you put your hand up and say, I want to change my fiat dollars, right? I want to change the energy reserves that I have unlocked, and I would like a portion of this fixed supply that represents the total accessible supply of energy in the world. As soon as you understand what is happening in that transaction and why you are receiving value or receiving more energy if you hodl, right? Mm. If you HODL, it's a very simple equation to understand why that's effective, not only for you, but for the entire world, right? Because you have access to this energy that you yourself could transform into something else. You could spend it. You could expend that energy on something else. But you don't have an idea that warrants the usage of that energy better than the market does. So you say, I'm going to exchange it. You take the energy now. That's what you're giving to the person on the other side of the trade. You're giving them now energy. They can do whatever they can turn that dollar, ultimate optionality that Michael Saylor talks about. They can turn it into anything that they want. But the beautiful part is if they're rational, the only reason that they would, the only reason they need energy now is because they're going to use it to transform even more energy. The best part is if they fail, they alone are punished. If they succeed, they're going to end up with more energy. They have to store it somewhere. Where's the rational place to store it? Is back in to Bitcoin. Yep. So they're going to then plug it back in, and it only gets bigger and bigger over time. The more that you say, I have these energy reserves, I don't want to consume them. Who has the best idea? And rather than going to a marketplace with 100 of the best stocks or a market that 100 million people can participate in and raise their hand and say, I got an idea. No, it's Bitcoin. It's permissionless. It's decentralized. It's open. Anyone can join. That means now we have an economy that has 7 billion options. Anybody that thinks that they have a good idea for energy, they can test it out. They can test it out by just saying, yeah, I'll sell my Bitcoin. I'll take that energy. I'll try and transform more. If I'm unsuccessful, I'm fucked. If I am successful, we all win.
That being able to store energy and being able to then feed energy back in and not having that same leakage like that the fiat currency system does. Michael Saylor had a quote. It talks about, you know, if you buy all of the gold's reserves today, all the gold in existence today, because of the inflation rate of around 2%, let's just say, in about 100 years, you'll only own about 25% of all gold in existence. Yep. Whereas if you buy 1% of all the Bitcoin in existence today, in 100 years, in 1,000 years, in 100,000 years, you will still own 1% of all the Bitcoin in existence. And I think that scarcity, that ability to store value and know it's not going to be inflated away is just, yeah, still so understated, despite it being probably something that's so prolific in Bitcoin vocabulary and mindset. It's something that is just, yeah, very profound, I think. And obviously, Steve understood that at that level.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's about wrapping your head around why HODLing, not only why it works, but why it is morally good that it works.
Mm.
Because the people that are at the bottom of the pyramid, they are sacrificing more because the risk is higher. So you can't do the work of the upper levels unless someone says, I'm not going to consume energy that I needed. I'm going to give it to somebody else who has a better idea that can use that energy to then build stuff, right? It takes energy to transform energy. So that is why, because you're at those lower levels, you are making the sacrifice of saying, I'm going to allow someone else in the marketplace, one out of the 7 billion possible people to take it. I'm going to find somebody out there that's going to take it. Then if they're successful, everybody wins.
That's right. Or even, I don't know what to do with it now, or I can't do with what I want to do with it right now. So I'm going to save it for a little bit later and then I'll do the investment. And I think this almost comes back to one of the economic principles, the Keynesian principles, which is, you know, we need people to spend money because GDP is the holy grail. And if people don't spend money and consume, then we don't have growth. But that is flawed at its base, because usually if people don't spend on consumer goods now, they tend to invest in capital goods later, and capital goods later tends to lead to things like more employment, more deflation, price deflation in a good way. So things become cheaper, technology becomes more abundant and accessible. And I mean, that's essentially what we're talking about now, is the ability to put in that work and to have, yeah, real feedback. So if we misallocate resources, we find out about it. And then those resources through creative destruction are freed up to be able to put to better use. And if what we put it to does work really well, we double down, we do more. Other people see and learn and they start to do the same thing and replicate and innovate. So it becomes this great, again, upward spiral rather than the inevitable downward spiral of the fiat currency, where we continually misallocate. And then we follow that up with further misallocation to try to undo what we did using the same things that got us there in the first place.
Absolutely. It makes perfect sense when you say it in the idea that people that are good at allocating energy to areas that need energy to transform even more, those people should be rewarded. We would, as a society, as a economy, which is just a group of individuals who decided to pool our energy. Let's all share energy. That's an economy, mm-hmm. right? The money represents the energy that has been transformed, and we have a call on that. We want the people controlling the energy who are the most effective at deploying it. that just makes sense because that's better for everyone because everyone ends up with more energy. So it's like as soon as you understand that, okay, well, yes, we should be rewarded for being successful with it. And then that way we can deploy more and it ends up helping more people. You start to put the pieces together and you're okay, this system actually makes sense. And it's true. What we want is we want people exchanging as much as possible because exchange means that the division of labor and specialty are actually doing their job and they're working and we are being more cooperative and we are transforming more energy. So yes, it is. Once you see these things, it's very hard. Like nobody ever goes backwards. You know, you never hear a story of someone becoming a Bitcoin maxi and then going, you know what? I was wrong. I should have gone all in on the dollar, you know, or the peso. Like I completely got this wrong. You don't hear it.
True. And I think it's that constant learning, you know, going back to probably the top of the episode, the idea of, you know, I don't know, but I'm curious to find out about it. I think Bitcoiners have that. And it's the concept in psychology. So there's personality, obviously, and there's usually about five different constructs in personality, which most things load back to. One of them is openness to experience, which often relates to things like creativity, which is not normally like seeing the solution. And that's the first one you find. Creativity is normally like coming up with 1,000 solutions, testing, getting feedback, getting actual feedback from the world as well as from other people that are coming up with solutions, and then refining it, you know, what's the word? Basically culling back to the thing that ends up being the solution. And I believe Bitcoiners, this is a bit of a theory that I have, I think, is that they're very high on openness to experience and very high on this creativity to be able to be open to seeing things beyond their current scope or beyond their current experience. And then once they see it working, they're willing to iterate on that and keep improving it and look at what other people are doing and you know, load off of that open network and learn from other people and benefit from other people.
Yeah, I would say yes. I would say the interesting part for me about that idea is that going to continue when it becomes the default? Like what active steps in education will have to take place in order to ensure that those ideas and those methods for reasoning continue to be rewarded. And I think because it is a value for value system, I think just inherently Bitcoin will do that because you have to contribute to the system in order to be validated essentially and to have access to reserves. I think that will continue, but it's interesting because you know, it makes sense from a personality aspect of those individuals that are able to adopt it early on. It's going to be interesting to see if that carries forward as it really does become the default based on the other systems imploding. Like we say, all it has to do is not die. That is actually all it has to do. And we know that it can't die. So will those things continue to carry forward? Or are we in the golden age of Bitcoin reasoning now when you have to in order to get by?
Would you say that's a threat to Bitcoin? Like what actually maybe answer that, but also the bigger question is like, what do you think would be perhaps the biggest threat? Like what on your mind would be the thing that we either need to be aware of and really cautious about with maybe not like Bitcoin specifically, unless there is something like that, but maybe about how the world sees Bitcoin or what they might use it for, or yeah, is there anything that you feel is a threat to Bitcoin? And maybe what you just mentioned there, is that maybe the biggest threat that we become a bit complacent or something as we move forward into Bitcoin adoption?
Yeah, I don't think it's complacency because I think anything, as we have seen in just biological evolution, right? And technology is non-biological evolution. It's just constant iterations of ideas, trying to figure out what's the best way to transform energy. And Bitcoin is the best way to allocate energy, which means it's going to be the best at transforming more energy, right? So there's no way that Bitcoin, when you think about it that way, there's really no system, at least that's in place now, that is going to give it a run for its money. So essentially, if it doesn't die, it's going to allocate energy better than anything else, any other alternative system, which means it will win. So from an idea perspective, I don't think it actually matters if people don't understand those things because they will be forced into this value for value model of they will have to contribute. I would say at the moment, the biggest thing, and I think, I don't know if you follow the Bitcoin Mining Council that Michael Saylor started up, if you've seen those quarterly breakdowns that they do, they are fantastic. I encourage people, if they haven't seen them, to go and check out the quarterly breakdowns by the BMC, even though there was a little bit of back and forth at the beginning when it was announced, just the way that it was announced and what the Bitcoin Mining Council would do. I think they've shown so far that the format of them delivering this information very concisely and hearing the problems that they are having, I think is really invaluable to the community and to people like me, whose job is to then go and talk to government agencies or corporations or even small businesses and talk about these are the facts. This is actually what's happening on the ground. Anyway, I went off on a tangent there. My point being that they talked about the number one threat or the number one thing that we needed to do, that they needed to do as miners. And that is education. That is getting on the front foot before the narratives build up the opposite way, because it's so much more work to overcome. As soon as you have, you only get one chance at a first impression, right? And the majority of individuals have had a negative first impression just based on legacy media. It's our job now. The facts and figures are on our side, both in the mining side of things, the economic policy side of things, the emergent monetary properties that come from Bitcoin. All of those things are on our side. We are winning in every single category, and you cannot deny it. The price reflects that people are waking up to the idea that this is winning. So now I think the most important thing that we can do is get people that have an ability to educate in front of as many people as we possibly can to help make the world a better place. And we can do that through Bitcoin.
Absolutely. I recall pretty early in my Bitcoin journey in, I believe it's Vijay Bhuiyapati's Bullish Case for Bitcoin essay, that he talks about one of the things that a new network or a new monetary network needs is people to evangelize it, to go out and talk about it. And that resonated with me. And I think I've sort of done that with my career before Bitcoin anyway. So it makes sense to be in this space. But I think you're absolutely right. That is still the low-hanging fruit, isn't it? Is to talk about Bitcoin to, you know, orange pill people. And you're right. You know, the flip side of that is that it could be the biggest threat, is because there is education on the other side, which is full of real misinformation, that is trying to, you know, derail Bitcoin. I don't think it's possible, but it still is going to take a lot of work to convince people and to convince the right people of it too. I understand the criticism of Bitcoin as not liking closed door or centralized or, you know, top-down control of things. So something like the Bitcoin Mining Council when it started was something that, you know, was a red flag for people. But I agree with you that what they've come out with so far and the transparency that they've had around their processes and the useful information that they've provided, it does seem like a net positive. And that might not be something that we need forever to have a central body that's doing that. But certainly for now, while that threat is there and while the low-hanging fruit for education is there and while no one else is doing that in a crowdsourced sort of open way, it makes a lot of sense. I think we need it. There's also one called BTC Policy, which looks at policy debates that are current and tries to come up with fact sheets to then go to, you know, Senate and Congress with. And of course, in Australia, we've got the Australian Bitcoin Industry Body, which is sort of opt-in, but at the same time has a very sort of similar MO, which is to understand what are the threats to Bitcoin or what are the perceived threats, what education people need, and who do we need to get on board to understand it. So yeah, I agree with you there. Education, big part of the strength of Bitcoin and what we need to do, but also the flip side is the, you know, to educate the uneducated. Otherwise, that could become a runaway train as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it would be naive to think that the legacy system is just going to go quietly into the night. They have every incentive to do the exact opposite. It is life or death. They are in a battle, and it really hasn't come to that yet. But Bitcoin is built for exactly that purpose. And again, the numbers are on our side, so it's more a game. I mean, speaking of government education, yesterday, myself and Steve spent the day at Parliament House here in Western Australia, just going over and discussing these exact things with ministers and senior policy advisors to those ministers. And the questions now, it's becoming unavoidable that people, much like we talked about, you know, you have that problem in your mind, you just don't know what it is. Everybody in the room that we spoke to, every single person, they are cognizant of the fact that there is something going on. And they need solutions. They don't know if Bitcoin is a solution, right? We just happen to be on the schedule and we just happen to talk to these individuals. But they know it. They know it. And it's just a matter of touch points. It's a matter of showing, again, reading the room and showing people how these small little individual wins can add up over time. And I think if we don't do it, if not us, then who? Right? Like that's the way we think about it as an organization. It's like, whose responsibility is it? If we need a foundation to be the best possible baseball team ever, and we can have a hand in it, we can build that. If we don't, we are doing a disservice to ourselves and at the same time doing a disservice to the community. So it's all about incentives. Bitcoin makes it so that I have, as someone who has put their life's energy into this storage unit, I have every incentive to go out there and tell people the pros and cons. I also have every incentive that if I'm wrong, to get out as fast as I can. So I'm both looking at the negative and looking at the positive and constantly running those numbers in my head and constantly getting that feedback from talks like we were doing yesterday, because, you know, everybody comes with their own set of problems. The government has very real problems that they are facing because they are essentially backed into a corner. They may not admit that they are backed into a corner, but we know full well that even the Australian government basically runs off of U.S. monetary policy. There's nothing that they can't shield themselves from that fact. And they can sense it. They're looking for solutions. And you've seen a bunch of different politicians come out on this idea that, well, this is an opportunity to grasp these things. And the quicker that I do it, the quicker I'm going to be able to leverage that first mover advantage. And we're seeing that across the board here in Australia as those conversations just slowly but surely start to change. And it's a big impact.
And it's a beautiful game theoretic thing where there is no downside to mentioning Bitcoin, but there is definitely an upside, which is why, and I'm glad to hear that this is starting to trend in Australia, Australian politics as well, because in America, we're starting to see politicians just fall over themselves just to mention the word Bitcoin, because they know immediately they'll get 10,000 new followers who will be in all their comments. And it's just, it's a no-brainer, really, to say it. And then, of course, that becomes the Trojan horse to learn about it and then to really believe it and then to really push for it as well, because it becomes contagious. And again, that one-way street phenomenon. I'm curious, has over the course of the last few months, I mean, especially since going on a Bitcoin standard, have you been approached increasingly by more, say, like politicians, businesses, and even other baseball teams? Has that been something that's just starting to become a frequent conversation where you don't need to go out to people to convince? Now people are coming to you and saying, all right, tell me about this thing. How does it fix this? Or how can I implement it? Is that happening more?
Absolutely. It's been the response. First of all, the response from the network in general, just the participants, the people, your average plebs was really astounding early on. Right? But we anticipated that there would be some sort of interest in a company doing this, because it was exactly what I would be excited about. You know, I have wanted to see, the proof is in the pudding. Can an organization with all the infrastructure in place, can we actually do it? Can we do all the tax implications? Can we do all the payroll? Can we do all the merchandise? Can we do all these things on Bitcoin? That was just a fun experimental side of things. And we knew, okay, that gives us a monstrous advantage. If another sports team came out right now and said, we are also going on a Bitcoin standard, they're behind the eight ball, because we have established relationships with individuals in the community that want to solve problems. And they can't solve those problems unless we present them, right? Because we have the forward-facing business issues. We have the forward-facing tax issues. We need to report those back. And those relationships and bonds grow stronger and stronger. And we are happy to lead from the front. And to your point, we have seen, we definitely didn't anticipate how much I would be on conversations just like this. Essentially, this will be number 9 for the week of either talking to corporations, just orange-pilling corporations. We've had CFOs call up and trying to get us on boardroom calls just to talk to the CEO about some ideas, from Fortune 500 companies down to medium-sized corporations, down to small businesses. You talked about other baseball teams reaching out. We've had entire baseball leagues, the commissioner of baseball leagues, reach out and say, this is something of interest. How do we get involved? Again, even going back to little mom and pop shops, it's happened so much, and we're spending so much time doing it that's one of the areas that we've identified. Okay, we need a better solution than we have now, because there's only so much time in the day. And I'm saying the exact same thing 5,000 times. So let's go with an onboarding process, because there really is a hole in, it's not education, it's part education, it's more accessibility of like the necessary paths. Like we talked about that document where you sort of lead someone their first 100 hours. It's like a small business that recognizes that something is wrong. They need, what can I do right now? And then what can I do the next 12 months to put myself in the best possible position to win? So we're developing our own playbook as to say, these are the people that we are confident in representing. Like, these are the people that have solutions. If they don't have all the solutions, they're at least the ones that will put their hand up and say, okay, we can come up with something, or we can have a stopgap. We need like people that are solutions based, especially now in the small business world, because it doesn't all work well. We knew that when we signed up. It doesn't. But that doesn't mean it's going to be like that forever. And the quicker that you can get in implementations of, you know, we need X, Y, and Z, and you guys only have X, how long is it going to take to get the next stuff? We're involved in those conversations. We are shifting where this whole ship is headed towards, just based off of that feedback loop. And people are starting to recognize that, and companies and corporations that reach out, every single time it gets easier. The slide deck gets better. The approach gets slicker. And it just gets, you start to dial in that orange pill pathway. And the better that we do it, the more excited they get, and they're doing the exact same thing. It just trickles down the entire way. So I think from government side of things, everybody that you can imagine, every level of government, national, local, schools have reached out from across the country, different organizations, they're all interested. And like I said, not a single negative, this is for drugs. No, not none of that. And it's all based on the proof of work that we aim to be a mouthpiece for the industry, because of the proof of work we've established in showing the community for the last 32 years that we want to be a positive impact. We're not trying to scam you. We're not looking for the quick exit. We're not doing Perth Heatcoin or something like that, where this is you're buying digital property rights, and this is why we can endorse them, and this is the companies that we can endorse to help get you there.
I had that as a question, actually, how you stopped shitcoining becoming a thing. Because I'm sure you, by the time it got to orange pilling, you probably would have known that that might be a tangent that people want to go on, which is like, how do we have our own, our Perth Heat coin? And then we can incentivize our members or our players using that, or, they get a discount with merchandise. Did that end up coming up? Is that something you can disclose? And if it did, how did you sort of like navigate it all back towards Bitcoin is the thing here? Let's not get distracted.
Absolutely. It was a thing, and it's continuing to be a thing, because I think people from the outside don't understand just how much money those companies that are involved in shitcoins, how much money they have compared to your Bitcoin-only companies.
Yep.
Like you hear about your Swans or your whoever's that only does Bitcoin, right? That market is so much smaller. They make so much less money because it's honest. It's value for value. You can't just print your own money, which is essentially what these places can do by preying on individuals that they're tricking into trading on their platform. And the temptation... Like if I was not involved and you just went as like a consultant to a sports organization, the volume of outreach that we get from these people, because they need legitimacy. They need exactly what we are selling, only we're not selling it. we're promoting what we think is a better alternative, but we are not for sale. But these companies, thick and fast, and which is why you see all of these places capitulate so quickly to the shitcoin casino, but we are in it for the long haul. They have the money. We have had numerous meetings with these companies, especially early days, trying to reach out saying, we want to be this exchange partner. We want to be this custodial partner. We want to be all those things. And from the Bitcoin community, it's so much smaller. It's so much. And these people are busy working on Bitcoin, which is, again, gets back to my where Perth Heat can add value, is we've identified that these companies that you hear about all the time that are really making a difference, they're making a difference because they are doing the work to make the difference, right? They're not doing other shit like marketing, trying to scam you into signing up for the thing so you get 20 extra bonus bucks or whatever it is. Like they are creating value as opposed to trying to siphon your value from you. So in terms of how we have said no, it's just making sure that the decision makers that see the checks coming in or see the potential for checks coming in, they understand that this is the long game. We are not scamming anybody. And I've said this multiple times on podcasts, don't trust us. Just like you don't trust the Bitcoin Mining Council. Don't trust me. You don't even know me. But you verify. Like, see the stuff that we are doing. If you see us and we come out and we're sponsored by Binance or whatever shitcoin casino you want to name, you should probably send questions or queries as to whether or not I've been kidnapped or something. Like, there's a problem. But it is a very real problem. Like, the level, the step down in the amount of money that these companies have access to is just undeniable. So I can see how it's going to be a real problem for organizations, for leagues, for companies to be able to hold off and get educated enough to when it comes to that they understand that they're taking all their reputation and they're flushing it down the toilet with one small move, and that's really high time preference thinking.
Absolutely. And gambling has always been a successful and profitable industry that has a great deal of power in terms of its ability to lobby and with politicians and regulation, as well as other businesses in terms of marketing and partnerships. And I think you guys are doing a service to the community and pioneers in setting up some of these, I guess I could just say on-ramps for other businesses to run on a Bitcoin standard, of course, because that would be part of some of the like the innovation that you were discussing earlier, but also by setting the moral exemplary to aspire towards, which is to understand this stuff at a level to not flush your reputation down the toilet for a quick win. And I think it's few and far between at the moment, but over time that will hopefully improve. And look, this podcast is sponsored by Hardblock, which is Australia's oldest Bitcoin only exchange, and they've had many, many opportunities to shitcoin over time too, and to their own detriment sometimes financially, they've gone against that and said, no, we're Bitcoin only. We don't want to do trading. We don't want to do leverage. We just want people to be able to dollar cost average. We don't even want people to sell. So we're basically removing the majority of ways that an exchange would make money just so we can make that available to other people. And if that means the exchange stays relatively small, that actually makes sense morally and ethically and the values. And so it is really good to see other organizations have that same ethos and are willing to sort of stand by it, sort of putting your money where your mouth is in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, well, I think the ability to think long term only exists because Bitcoin exists. Mm-hmm. Right? Because in every other sense, if it was only a fiat world, what other organizations would be up against, the shitcoin casino money would make sense to take it. It would make sense to say, give me, I'll flush my reputation straight down the toilet. Just give me as many cuckbucks as I can possibly get right now because I need them, because they're going to go, they're going to be worth less and less and less. I need to spend them now in order to get any value, because it's not worth. There's nothing that can actually store the value that I would bother doing the hard road for. Like, why would I continue to build up a positive reputation when I can just, I'm going to do the same thing then that I'm going to do right now. So I might as well do it now. So Bitcoin's existence allows for this type of attitude and for this implementation of values. This is what we're going to do, because yes, hard blocks has taken hits on the very, very short term, right? You think about this on the long term. You pull back from a 1 year time horizon to a 20 year time horizon, and you start to see, well, that you are actually doing yourself a huge disservice by taking that initial money. And those are conversations that are real, especially you get involved in corporate board meetings where some people will have different ideas. These are arguments that will take place, and you have to come to the party ready to say, this is exactly why this is a huge fucking error. Mm. And if we do these things, we are completely flushing everything down the toilet, and it may look good on the next, the quarterly statement, but it's going to look like shit 20 years from now. And getting people on board and saying, this is a real problem, making sure everyone knows the stakes. Because if people don't know the stakes and they don't know the incentives, they can't make a base judgment. And that's still to this day, even my role even then is to just make sure that everyone understands that this process is not a typical fiat process of, let's just, in the sports world, you have whatever, a 3 month season, and you got 9 months to get ready for the next season. And the day after that season starts, all of our jobs are occupied with, okay, how are we going to get the sponsors on board for the next year? What are we going to offer? What incentives? What are we going to do? This. Bitcoin completely eliminates that. If the thesis plays out to a fraction of what we believe it's going to play out in, there will be no need for sponsored ad breaks interrupting your example of low time preference behavior. That will completely go away because we will be able to operate on our own. And so these are the incentives that we're going after. And this is something to constantly remind individuals, because it's really quick. Once you see those dollar signs, it's really quick to say, it's like the dogs when you ring the bell and they start slobbering. It's like they're still, even now, in an organization that is so orange-pilled, there's still the temptation of like, oh, what? Like, we could get now, right now, we could get that? Well, let's do it. And you're like, no. That's not going to work. We're actually doing ourselves a huge disservice.
It would just be a repeat of the fiat system, but with a new skin on top, same as gambling. Now it just has a skin on top called cryptocurrency trading.
Yep.
And it's beautiful to see this play out on an individual level. You with storing your wealth in Bitcoin versus, say, a friend or family or someone who you've never met storing it in fiat currency instead. You can see that play out in the long term, seeing it play out for organizations like yourselves and even at nation state levels, because sometimes that will come up where people say, well, if a nation state went to a Bitcoin standard, what about other countries that didn't? Wouldn't they hold an upper hand because they can inflate their own currency away? They can manipulate the price to make exports or imports more attractive depending on their policies. And you would say, yeah, that's true. They can do that initially, and that might be considered a success, but then they end up with the inevitable problems that fiat currency always ends up with down the track, while at the same time, the hard currency keeps accruing in value, bringing that nation that's on a Bitcoin standard, say, out of debt, giving them greater power and influence and the ability just to actually further their society in a more long-term sustainable way. That's actually going to get better over time. It's going to be like a feedback loop in a really positive way, even while other countries in the meantime get to deflate their currency inflate the amount of their currency and deflate the value away. It's just short-term thinking. So it's really great to see this playing out on so many like individual, organizational, and nation state scales, and for people to start to understand that a bit better. It's basically a good thing when other businesses or other countries don't go to a Bitcoin standard for yourselves initially, or at least, I guess, in the long term. If they're your competitors, that's a good thing. And look, if they join you and join the Bitcoin standard, that's an even better thing, because now you both get to collaboratively compete and both work for this network, which actually benefits both of you, even if you're competing with each other. It's just, positives both way, win-win, essentially, for Bitcoiners.
Yeah, the game theory on a nation state level is, once you wrap your head around and understand the implications of, you quickly see why a country like El Salvador, it makes perfect sense for them to make an allocation and be very boastful about it and try and get as many people on the network talking about it as they can. And you see the flip side of that is a country like the United States would be the last thing that they would want to do is tell people that they were actually doing it, because it would put them at such a disadvantage to accumulate more to stop that capital flight. I mean, Christine Lagarde talking about how if there is an escape valve, people will use it. That's exactly right.
Yes.
That's what you have to prepare for. That is what you have to prepare for. It's like the game theory is, yes, you better be accumulating as much as you can, as fast as you can, so that you can capture that escape. And if you can't capture the economic energy that is escaping, you're going to be in a really, really tough spot. And that goes for, like you say, for corporations, for our, you know, I can speak about the Perth Heat. Our competitors not adopting a Bitcoin standard gives us a huge advantage going forward. But the best possible team that we can be only works if all the other teams are on a Bitcoin standard. Like that is when we reach peak efficiency. So yeah. It's a battle between, yes, we want to put ourselves in the best possible space going forward as an entity, but larger than that, whatever will emerge from the efficiency boost that Bitcoin will give to the economy of the world, whatever emerges from that, whatever life emerges from that to take advantage of it, is going to be better than what we are doing right now. And that's something that you really have to remember. And you can see it on a biological level every single time innovation takes place in energy transformation. It's like the single cell goes to the multi-cell because the multi-cell is better at transforming energy, and something emerges from that. It builds up, it becomes so efficient at transforming energy and storing it and having access to it that something else emerges from it. Something else that can take advantage of these huge energy efficiency gains. And that's what we're seeing right now. And who knows what emerges from the efficiencies? We don't know. We're not there. But it's going to be exciting. And that's really the pinnacle. So you're fighting, yes, for ourselves. We want to accumulate as much as we can, as fast as we can. But at the same time, we don't reach peak efficiency for everyone. Like I want everyone operating to the best of their ability because I know that makes my life better. I don't want to be surrounded by people that are, you know, losers that aren't producing anything because that puts all the onus on me. Now I have all of the pressure to do all of the things that I want. I want to do one thing really, really well. And I want to cooperate and exchange with everyone else who's super happy because they're all doing the things that they love and they're creating value and we can all share. You know, it's like kumbaya moment of Bitcoin is if everyone's acting in their own self-interest with all of the incentives in place, everyone wins. And everyone wins to the maximum.
It's the first non-zero-sum game, especially financially, but I would just say energy-wise with our human action that we've probably ever had. Yep. We're working together, competing against each other with our own personal individual interests in mind will actually benefit everyone. Have you ever seen the movie Arrival? It's about, yes. It's about aliens. The ending of that, like the non-zero-sum game where, you know, everyone gets the ability to see into the future and therefore attacking each other just becomes completely irrelevant of an idea. And then it forces people into some level of collaborative competition. I think that concept in and of itself, I mean, game theory all over, I know that's sort of at the root of it, but it's something that I don't think will even be able to fathom the positive impacts of it until we get to 100 years, 1,000 years time and really get to see what sort of things can come out of this that are not even related to Bitcoin remotely in our minds at the moment, but Bitcoin will enable because of the collaborative effort that will, you know, that will be enabled and incentivized to actually, you know, put into practice. Whereas at the moment, people that aren't on a Bitcoin standard, they're still fighting just to compete.
Yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes back to your fire example of how many things have come out of just our ability to control that fire and to see it going forward. But yes, I think the ability to recognize what is coming is just not possible. And that's one of the things I also, you know, I like to, because you have to get people in that mindset to realize that their beliefs on their day-to-day interactions with the world, they're fallible. Like the mistakes can be made along the way, which will make them less efficient. If you're in an orange pilling session, a really easy way to do that is to just show people how little they know about numbers, about math, about anything in the world around them. If you do the classic one is the 30 linear steps versus 30 exponential steps. Like you say, how far is 30 linear steps going to go? And they say, oh, you know, to the door. And they say, okay, 30 exponential steps. And they say, oh, to the end of the block or something. It's like, okay,
to the moon.
Yeah. Exactly. This is why this stuff is really hard to understand, because you're not meant to, you're not working with this type of energy, this type of math every single day. It's really hard to grasp. So as dumb as you feel right now, that's how you should feel about Bitcoin. And so from there, we're going to build up a level of understanding, because that's how far behind the curve you are. That's how little you know is exactly your answer to that exponential question. And that's a really good place just to, again, just shift people's mind to, you know, I know what I'm talking about. I saw this on the news. Bitcoin wastes a ton of energy. To being like, oh, okay, I'm an idiot and I don't know anything, but I'm okay with admitting that I'm an idiot because I was just shown it. And now I'm in a safe space where now you can tell me how to get a little bit smarter, to wise up and be a little bit more efficient.
That example that you give is so great. I think Jeff Booth has an example about folding the bit of paper.
Yes.
Like if you fold a bit of paper 30 times or 32 times or some arbitrary amount, essentially once you get to 30, it goes to the moon and back. And most people are like, no, that wouldn't, it doesn't make sense. You know, no way. Just Google it. You can duck, go it rather than Google it. You can find that out. But even getting someone to fold a bit of paper, they think they can do it so many more times than what they actually can. They get to whatever it is, 5 or 6, and it's just like, it just doesn't work anymore. It's just too much. But our brain doesn't fathom those sort of big numbers. And the not just the big numbers, but the exponential curve of those numbers and where that can go to, which again is why some of the price predictions probably seem so insanely bullish. But then when you understand how much currency is in the world looking for a place to park that's going to be positive or at least just going to be neutral and store its value, you see the potential for those sort of exponential curves become much more likely.
Yeah, that's why, I mean, I try as little to mention price as little as possible, because that is when the red flags go up for everyone. Is you cannot sound too bullish. It's impossible to sound too bullish because people have never encountered absolute scarcity. They don't understand that as demand increases, you cannot supply more to the market. Like that is it. So it will go. And when it goes, when word gets out that a first world nation has decided to put it on the balance sheet and they've decided to come out and actually say that, well, then it is a race. And there is no fucks given about what price you get in at that stage from any of the nation states. Yep. They're like, I can take the stuff that we're making for free. I mean, Jason Lowry does the best job of presenting the idea behind what little incentive there is not to, if you can print your own money to buy Bitcoin. You know, if you're taking the energy from your for free, you're taking the energy from you're siphoning off the energy of your citizens anyway. You're not even paying for it yourself. You can just print up these pieces of paper that will allow you to claim something that is absolutely scarce. It just makes zero sense. And people, you know, you can't describe to people where the price is going because it's too bullish. As soon as you understand the Bitcoin game theory, but it's also unavoidable. So it's like, how crazy am I versus how crazy do I want you to know that I am, right? And it's true. You cannot avoid it. And once you sit down, that really is where you will have a moment where you get off this podcast and you'll think about it. And you go, okay, well, what if they buy? Okay, then they have to buy and they won't care about price. And I'm not going to sell. Like, you're never getting my Bitcoin. So fuck, that's a lot of money. And it's really fast. And it's over like that. You know, you've seen those more and more on Twitter now. You're starting to see the Weimar chart next to the Bitcoin chart. And you see it's getting very close to that end. And of course, you know, it's a nice analogy. It doesn't have to happen that way. But eventually that will happen. Eventually there will be the candle that you think, oh, it's going from 40 to 60. But it's not. It's going from 40 to 600 like that. You wake up. I'm still shocked. Every day I wake up in the morning, you know, you check the Bitcoin price and I'm like, I can't believe it. Nobody found out. Like we made it another day without anybody finding out. It's still surprising.
More time to stack.
That's it. And one day it will not be like that. And it'll be like, you know, you'll be sitting around the campfire talking about, yeah, there was a chance when somebody could own a whole Bitcoin.
I've even heard it'll be almost rare, well, maybe it will be completely rare in the future that people will transact on-chain because the price in and of itself of fees will just make it completely inaccessible for most. And not to mention, most wouldn't have the amount of Bitcoin that would then warrant sending on-chain in the first place. Most people would just operate on Lightning or a third or a fourth layer on top of that, which, again, sounds unfathomable now until you start to think of that exponential curve and how expensive, you know, it can get. And it starts to make a lot of sense. I'm actually very similar to you in that I try not to bring up Bitcoin price too much anymore. It always comes up inevitably in the conversation, but it's more about the fundamentals than anything else, because that's really the most interesting stuff. And I think the price is just, it's a foregone conclusion at this point. It's just a matter of time than anything else. Having said that, now that we're talking about price, I'm curious that you have staff, you have players. What have people's reactions been? Are people kind of comfortable with the fluctuations that have gone on the last few months? Or have you had some people that have come to you concerned that needed a bit of consoling and need a bit of a reassurance? What's that been like?
No, I think it speaks to sort of the trust that the players, the organization has in Steve and sort of the education that we did early on about how price is really, we don't have too many people in the organization, and we would be very honest with them if that were the case, that are close to retirement age. It's one of the fantastic things about working with athletes. Like you say, they have a very small window, but it's usually at the beginning of their lives when they have ample time on the backside to be able to take some outsized risk. Now, I don't think it's outsized risk. I think it's a matter of education and just getting people to understand exactly what is happening when the price fluctuates, who's in the market and who's not in the market. But we haven't seen any panic. You know, the if anything, we have seen the positive benefits of just a collective idea that is positive, because there's no one getting left behind in the organization. The conversations around the water coolers, everyone is now positive because we have this goal in mind. We have recognized collectively just how big an impact we have the potential to play, and people are excited about the opportunity of, yes, going out and winning another baseball championship, yes, but also we legitimately have the possibility to make incredible inroads into making the world a better place for Bitcoin. And I think there has been more excitement around that, and the realization that, again, especially from the staff, it's like they're around it so much now. They're around these conversations and these orange peeling sessions so much now that they're starting to recognize and be able to say the same things that I'm saying. They're able to say those things, and they start to build that conviction, and they start to say, okay, well, yes, this helps me, and I'm going to start helping other people too. I'm going to help my family. I'm going to help everybody involved. And the price is just an opportunity to do that cheaper. I think so far the feedback has been nothing but positive.
That's great. Are there any announcements, anything that you want to sort of spruik for Perth Heat that's coming up?
I would say, there's many things that I would like to announce. Probably the most exciting initiative that we have had, the most back and forth from not only on the government side of things, but the actual corporation side of things, is Steve, our CEO, was recently did a tour of the US, because even now, especially the Bitcoin world, it is from the outside or from Bitcoin Twitter, it can look quite large. There's lots of players involved, but really it's still a very much a relationship business at the top. The top of the Bitcoin mining world, there's only so many companies and so many individuals that are involved with those companies. So Steve did a big tour with all of the people in the space, everyone that you can think of. Steve went and visited with and talked with, because we're trying to get the idea out of this is what we're doing, and these are the reasons why we're doing it. And this is why we think the Bitcoin network, which is why we're looking support from the Bitcoin network to actually back this thing and actually to see whether or not it's feasible that we can operate this way. And out of that has come, probably the most exciting thing has come, that we're looking to do, we're looking to be the first at a number of different things. But one area that we have identified is just Bitcoin mining. Bitcoin mining, the gross misunderstanding by the public of what that is. Some of the ways that we can educate individuals on, or the public on, how it is good, the incentives that align for expending energy in order to become more efficient at transforming it. All of those things have meant that we're going to be mining Bitcoin at the ballpark. We're going to be basically in cooperation with the entire Bitcoin network and the people that provide the hash to the Bitcoin network. That will mean we'll be able to remove a ton of, you know, it's not going to be whatever ballpark sponsored by so-and-so. It's like the Bitcoin network can actually sponsor the ballpark. They can actually say, through the mining operations, through the amount of energy that we're able to provide to the network, Bitcoin can reward the team for doing that. And that's one of the largest things. We've also got our season coming up finally. Right? 2021 was completely cut off, which was a huge pain after the announcement. To get that news was really devastating, because we had a whole bunch of things planned. But we've got a number of different collaborations and businesses putting their hand up to say, this is an organization that I think we can help, and I think we can magnify their message. And so for the Bitcoin mining side of things, that's probably the most exciting, the most real right now that I'm dealing with on a day-to-day basis, is just what is that going to look like, what the education stems from there, how we can use that to leverage our conversations with government, with other corporations. But it's really exciting to be able to do that, because there are opportunities at professional sports facilities. They're only used a certain number of days every single year. There's a ton of space there. There's a ton of power normally to these places. It's about coming up with contracts with energy providers and making it realistic. And then, from a government standpoint, it's then taking those funds, and it's a win-win. They take those funds that they are able to generate at whatever, the local football club, if they're able to do some sort of Bitcoin mining there, they can take that and they can fund registration fees, or can fund uniforms or whatever kit. And those are immediate wins that people can get behind. They can see the value in it, and they can see that it's really, you can't not do it, because there is no downside, right? The downside is you would have spent that money on some other facet inside of the community. This is just doing it from the inside out.
That makes a lot of sense. My motto is secure and expand the network. Expand being talk about Bitcoin, get people involved, but then also get people mining Bitcoin as well. And so it's really great to see that you guys are jumping into that. And, a recent stat that I saw was something like 70% of the world's energy production is wasted with storage and transmission. And just being able to harness a fraction of that puts us forward as individuals and as society in a really significant way, very noteworthy.
Absolutely. I think just to comment on that before we go on, that is the biggest thing. Yesterday was a prime example, sitting down with these senior policy advisors, and they get the same moment, the same look on their face when you mention, much like with Jordan Peterson in his podcast, the original one with the four, Gigi was on there, a bunch of other people were on there, and he comes to the realization that you can monetize energy wherever it is.
It clicked.
It's like when you see the reactions of the people that are in charge of powering the grid and making sure it's ample, and then you see it on their face, and that's like a moment that you never come back from. You know, we have them forever now. They will be incentivized just in their own mind because it's such a revolutionary idea.
It's probably one of the unspoken things as well, because people do talk a lot about the Bitcoin network as payment rails, the Bitcoin price, the token or the asset itself, as well as some of the things that can be built on top of it, like Lightning Network or some of the stuff Impervious AI is doing with VPNs or browsers and telephone calls and everything else. But just the fact that it revolutionizes the energy industry is, I think, going to be the next revolution of people understanding Bitcoin and getting into Bitcoin and positioning themselves in large organizations to try to take advantage of that in a good way. I'm conscious of time. I know we're approaching about 2 hours, so I've got a couple of final questions for you. One's just final thoughts, but the question before that is, are there any tangent Bitcoin topics that you didn't realize that you would get into when you got into Bitcoin? So what I mean by that is, like carnivore diet tends to be linked in really well with Bitcoin nowadays. I mean, I could give other examples, but that is a big one for a lot of people, I think. And I'm just curious, like, when you got into Bitcoin, was there something else that's come up that's become like a life-changing thing that you didn't realize Bitcoin related to? You didn't realize it was going to push you down this tangent? Or has most of it seemed, I guess, sensical enough in terms of where it's led you?
No, I mean, I would say the biggest impact that Bitcoin has made, which I go back to that to the beginning, which in my mind was tangential because I didn't think it mattered, was I thought, again, like most people do, that Bitcoin was just an investment to stack more fiat because I didn't understand what the money represented anyway. And it took me a long time to come to grips with and a bunch of different educators in the space. Even I, who was out there looking for it, it took a really long time to solidify the idea and actually grasp it of what that money represented. And that is the biggest thing that I wasn't expecting. I was expecting, okay, I'm going to get 100% returns, I'm going to cash out, I'm going to put that in Amazon, and, you know, I'll be able to buy the beach house with that. And little did I know that it would change every activity that I do. It changes you from the inside out. Everything that I am involved in, it changed my jujitsu, it changed my working out of the gym, it changed my diet, it changed everything that you can think of, because it is the base level of how do I transform as much energy as I can? Well, I need to be as efficient as I can. How can I be as efficient in every single aspect of my life? Because that's going to make me better. If it makes me better, it makes all the people around me better. And it just trickles out into your entire life. And you hear, you know, podcast after podcast talk about these life-changing moments that happen with Bitcoin. And it slowly over time, it just, that Bitcoin doesn't seep in, but the ideas that are central to Bitcoin, the incentives that are there, the things that emerge from truth, you seek more and more of. And I think it has made me try and seek truth more actively than before, rather than be a passive sort of sidecar to day-to-day existence. Now it's truth and seeking it and spotting the bullshit and calling it out.
Being, again, curious, being open to new experiences. And I think just beautifully said as well, again, going back to the first principle, it's Bitcoin, it's understanding that and understanding, I guess, the underpinnings of it, which is, you know, money, energy, time preference. And that does become something that if you adopt that at your core, it does become prolific in everywhere else in your life as well. It's hard for it not to, I think, because we are a bit cynical and open to experience and to be curious. We know when we're being disingenuous or inauthentic in another aspect of life. And then we can't, I think most Bitcoiners can't deal with that. They would want to change that, even if it's going to put things into upheaval for a while. It's worthwhile to do.
Absolutely. I think Bitcoin, as soon as you allow Bitcoin into your life and you understand it, it's significantly harder to push the shitty parts of your life under the rug. Like, you are faced with them. You know, the rug has been pulled back and now you have to stare at them. So it motivates you. The incentives are aligned to fix those things because they will just be preying on you the whole time.
And there's a personal responsibility there as well. It becomes more of an internal locus of control of like, well, I can do something about this now that I know what the problem is and that there is this solution here and that this solution can relate to many other aspects of life. It's no longer something that I'm looking at others and saying they're to blame or I shouldn't feel guilty or I shouldn't do anything about it because it's their responsibility. It's all back to that internal locus, that personal level.
Definitely.
Any final thoughts? And in that, perhaps let people know where they can follow you if they don't already know. I'm not sure how, but just in case they don't.
No. The easiest way to follow is just through the Perth Heat. That's where you'll find the majority of the stuff. I've also got Twitter as well. I can't remember the handle off the top of my head, but it's out there somewhere. I don't really think it's that much though.
CBO_21, but either way, yes. I'll add it to the post when I put it up just in case that's wrong.
Yep. And again, like I say, when I close out all of these things, either Orange Pilling Session or podcast, it's like, please don't trust, please verify exactly what we're doing, because we need people to keep us on the straight and narrow. And when we're actively looking for that, and if you've got ideas about what small business should be doing or an organization like ourselves, please feel free to reach out. Like, we are the Bitcoin network is the smartest network in the world, and we're looking to leverage that. We know that there are individuals out there that with ideas that are completely well beyond the ideas that we will have, and we're looking forward to access those and take advantage of them. So please, if you have ideas, if you have areas of interest, or you see things that we're doing that you don't like, please reach out and keep us honest.
I think the thing that I'm bullish on more than Bitcoin is Bitcoiners. There's just some really intelligent people in the space, and we're draining the fiat system every day, getting more and more intelligent, motivated, and innovative people that are willing to collaborate and share and help each other out, which is awesome. And look, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for everything that you're doing with Perth Heat. And if there's anything that I can ever do or Hardblock can ever do to help, please reach out to us as well. We're happy to collaborate on anything that's you know, that comes up that seems viable.
Absolutely. Pleasure being on. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for listening. If you liked or think this is relevant for anyone, please share it around. If you've got any comments or queries or content suggestions, please just comment on either my personal Twitter, which is mission_Bitcoin, or even the Hardblock Twitter, which is HardblockBTC, all one word, HardblockBTC. And otherwise, until next time, thanks for listening.